Scene 6, Isaac Asimov, 10:50 a.m. A new voice broke in, and I looked up. It was Asimov walking in some 10 minutes early. He said, "Darius, you've come to hear me say my piece. I'm touched." I think he really was. Why else did he refrain from calling me Darius Dust, and then choking himself red in the face on the wit of it? However, fair's fair. Since he gave up Darius Dust for that one time, I didn't let on that it was strictly an ulterior motive that had drawn me into the room. I said, "I can count on you to be interesting, Isaac." Apparently that merely heightened his philanthropic mood, which the clear absence of much of an audience did not seem to dampen, and he said, "Would you like to meet the other panelists?" "Why not?" I said. I turned to Strong and said, "You'll pardon me, I hope." He mumbled what I thought was an affirmative. What else can anyone give under the circumstances? And off I went. Later, when I looked back, I didn't see him. Clearly, he had left to report to Marsogliani on me. I was vaguely sorry I had had to upset him in my desire to double-check on the duplicity of Sarah Voskovic. Actually, the panelists were a rather impressive group. With an air of eager and cheerful proprietorship, Asimov introduced me to Carl Sagan, an astronomer at Cornell, tall and slim with dark hair and dark eyes and a quick way of speaking. Asimov introduced me as a real writer, a remark I presume designed to elicit assurance that he too was a real writer. Footnote 1. Needless to say, it was not so intended, Isaac Asimov. Footnote 2. Modesty then? Please, Darius Just. Sagan nodded amiably, but I have a sure instinct for people who have heard of me. Sagan hadn't. Walter Sullivan of the New York Times was the moderator. He was even taller than Sagan, and thinner, white-haired, ruddy of complexion, and so eager to please that when I was introduced as a writer, he said, "Oh, yes," as though he read himself to sleep with me every night. I was nearly fooled. Asimov didn't know the other two personally, but they required no real introductions. One was Charles Berlitz, who had just written a book on the Bermuda Triangle, tall, round-faced, and gray-haired, and the other was Uri Geller, the Israeli semi-mystic who was supposed to bend keys by telekinesis, to read minds, and so on. Geller was young and very attractive, both in appearance and in conversation. It was clearly Asimov and Sagan versus Berlitz and Geller, with Sullivan trying to remain impartial but unable to resist toppling over onto the side of rationality. The panel discussion, however, lacked excitement. I don't know whether the poor attendance dampened the spirits of the panelists or whether some precognition of the lack of clash had kept the audience down. Either way, it was a quiet hour. Or most of it was. Toward the end, there was a challenge from the floor when someone dared Geller to subject himself to an audience of magicians, doing so in somewhat provocative language. Geller, who was used to this sort of thing, was careful not to betray himself into losing his temper. He simply stated that he would never do any demonstrations before magicians, because it was useless to do so. They would never believe anything he did was anything but trickery, no matter what the circumstances. That seemed to stir Asimov. He leaned over to whisper something to Sullivan and was duly recognized. "I do not think," he said, "that the problem of the refusal to believe on the part of magicians is a serious one. It is paralleled by a far greater, and far more intense refusal to disbelieve on the part of almost everybody else. I do not wish to speak specifically of Mr. Geller, though this applies to him, for it is true of anyone who invades the area lying outside the narrow and constricted boundaries of what scientists will, without serious argument, accept. The parascientific fringes are intrinsically glamorous. They are exciting and delightful, and they court belief. Millions will grant the belief and will not be deterred by anything scientists will say, especially since scientists cannot counter with anything equally evocative, but can only grumble a spoil sport, 'It isn't so.' In fact, so eager are people to believe the essentially incredible that they will resent, even with violence, any effort to advance evidence in favor of disbelief. If some mystic with a wide and ardent following were to disown all his previous statements, if he were to declare his miracles frauds and his beliefs charlatanry, he would lose scarcely a disciple. since one and all would say he had made his statements under compulsion or under a sudden stroke of lunacy. The world will believe anything a mystic will say, however foolish, except an admission of fakery. They actively refuse to disbelieve. Is there, therefore, anything to be accomplished by arguing against mystics, or by trying to analyze their beliefs rationally? As a healthful exercise to improve and strengthen one's own rationality, certainly. As a hope to reform fools, never. But it doesn't matter. My own attitude is to bid the world believe. All of you, believe. Believe whatever you want. For in doing so, whatever misery you bring upon yourself and others, you will nevertheless never affect reality. Though all Earth's 4 billion swear from top to bottom and left to right that the Earth is flat, and though they kill anyone who dares suspect it might be an oblate spheroid with a few minor irregularities, the Earth will nevertheless remain an oblate spheroid with a few minor irregularities. There was a polite patter of applause, and the hour came to an end. I didn't applaud, even though I once again marveled at how easily, and I suspect unconsciously, Asimov could shift from the essential triviality of his social personality to the intense intelligence of his professional one, and back again, since Asimov's little speech took all my painfully gathered grounds for certainty and shook them badly. I believed in the murder of Giles Devore, and so far had refused to accept any reasons advanced to support the contrary. Were there any conceivable reasons I would accept, or was I a true believer, dedicated to my belief though the heavens fall? If Giles himself were to rise from the dead and swear that he had not been killed but had slipped in the bathtub, would I not reject that too? Would I not say that whatever had happened, whatever the attack, it had been so sudden and came from a source so trusted that Giles himself was mistaken and took murder for accident? And if I were a true believer, would my belief, however firm and inalienable, in the least change reality?